Okay, we're in session two now. We've got three panelists, Roy Crivell from Oslo, Daniel Murray from Stanford, and a colleague of mine, April Currier from Ottawa.
Can you hear us?
I can hear you.
Yes.
We'll like to keep the time between 10 and 15 minutes, if you can. So we'll start with Roy, and then we'll go to Daniel, and then April's last. Go ahead.
If she's still here.
Yeah.
Try not to make any stupid mistakes here.
Okay. So that's the PowerPoint.
That's one.
That's not.
And then the picture, please. Okay. I was communicating with Alex when I was writing the article, saying that I was struggling with the language, and he convinced me that you're understanding all this. I hope that's right. Right?
Sorry, I was, yes.
Understand. So, what I'd like to do here is, I'm not 100%, not even 50% satisfied with the paper I wrote, so I will take this opportunity and try to make my arguments a little bit clearer. And hopefully you can help me, because I realize now that I'm not a political scientist, I'm not a philosopher, I'm a historian. Which means that I have a lot to learn about the anarchism through the history. But first, before I begin, I would like to show you this quite famous... How can I get...
I have no idea, I'm afraid. I can't seem to get rid of it.
But you can see it.
Yeah.
This is a painting which is quite famous internationally. It has been reproduced in at least 20 different cities all over the world. It was originally painted on the Casa Comunal, which is the main building or the communal building in Ricardo Flores Magón, which is one of the villages or autonomous municipalities in Chiapas, in Las Cañadas. What I would like you to note is that while there's a lot of people around doing stuff and works, a lot of things, you have also two different circles there. You have one circle here and another one behind here. The first one is the circle of men, and the other one is the circle of women. From distance it's difficult to see, but you can also see that they're all, at least the women are dressed up in Tzeltal, I guess it's Tzeltal shirts. And the point I'm trying to make here is that the conception they have of community involves being a member of a community which is also defined by your sex, your gender. You're not only a member, individual member of the community as such, but you're also a member of a subgroup defined by gender. I'll try to come back to that. It's still not going away.
No, it's not going away, is it?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Just click one of the choices, maybe, and then...
I don't want to
cancel.
Yeah.
No,
it's going away. That's perfect.
Okay.
So let's try to make my arguments clear. Let's begin with the international relations theory. I found it interesting that these guys from the RAND, you pronounce it like RAND,
yeah,
RAND,
yeah.
Corporation, was saying that the Zapatista uprising demonstrated how new technology now made it possible for swarms of flies to overrun the governments. While I would not use the same terms, I found it fascinating. From my political perspective, I'm not against that. And Manuel Castells saw the development of global networks facilitated by the internet as revolutionary. And he claimed that old style hierarchical, sorry about that, organizations would be no match for flexible networks. I like that too. And Cleaver, in a famous article, said that he was observing the fabric of politics being rewoven. And even Holloway, coming closer to home, arguing for changing changing the world without taking power. So 15 years ago, in the mid-1990s, we can observe a certain amount of optimism. Things are changing. And some of these changes are related to technology. And these technological changes will facilitate political changes. Politics are being revolving. Now, what I will try to argue here is that in 1996, when the Zapatistas and the government were negotiating the deal in San Andres, this came to a halt. I'm not, for the lack of a better word, I would say that the dialogue or the conflict has been frozen at this point since 1996. It has not been frozen, but the conflict is revolving around the theme of indigenous identity and indigenous rights. And it is still the reason why there's no dialogue between the two parties. I'm not saying that there should be a dialogue or that they should ask for autonomy from a government. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that the focus point of the conflict is now revolving around indigenous rights and what it means to be indigenous. Some changes was made to the constitution. Some of you might remember the caravan to Mexico City in 2001, but that fell short of the original agreement in San Andres and is not living up to the standards which Mexico has accepted in the International Labour Organization's Convention of Number 169. Okay, I'm using too much time. How many time have I?
7 minutes.
Left. So the second step of my argument would be to compare Chiapas with other indigenous experiences in Central America or Latin America. Nicaragua, where they accepted a new constitution during the Civil War in 1987, accepting two regions on the Atlantic coast with autonomy. Panama, San Blas, autonomy. Costa Rica also for indigenous people. Guatemala as part of the peace agreement between the UNG and the government. Brazil and a lot of other cases. Before and after 1996, before and after, especially after all those optimistic statements about new power relations, we see that other places, similar claims to autonomy, indigenous autonomy, have been accepted. But in Mexico, the government has declined and still declines to fulfill the obligations the government took on in 1989, signing the international conventions. So that should give reason to reconsider these propositions of changing power relations. Could it be that it's not so dramatic what was observed in the 1990s? In the article, I try to do many things. I have to skip most of it here. And that's one of the problems with the article. I try to do everything at the same time, which is seldom a very good idea. I try to say something about why international and global activists found it interesting to cooperate with the Zapatistas. There's many good reasons for that. And I also tried to see how the communication between the two groups mutually helped each group or facilitated the self-identification of the two groups. Methodology you'll find more on in the paper. One of the things I think we need to be clear about is that when we talk about one global movement in 1994-95, 5,000 people coming to a small village in Chiapas to dialogue with the Zapatistas, we actually talk about four different networks or movements. One was based on a struggle against a common enemy, which was the governing party of Mexico. Some call that a democratic movement. The second movement consisted of a large number of independent peasant organizations demanding land reform. That should be understood in the historical perspective, going back to Emiliano Zapata and his plan of Ayala in 1914, which gave every landless peasant the right to land. That was not always the case. They did not all get land, of course, but they had the right to demand land from the state. And this right was abolished leading up to the free trade agreement with the United States and Canada in 1994. The third movement, sub-movement, was an indigenous movement. And the fourth movement was the type of movement I will discuss here, the global solidarity movement dominated by what can loosely be defined as anarchists. I know that quite a lot of people would deny any tags, would not call themselves anarchists. But for the sake of simplicity, I'll call them anarchists here today. And I tried to define from 94 until today three or four stages or phases. The first phase involves constructing the Zapatistas. First, that the Zapatistas practiced a particular version of participatory democracy. That was not obvious at all. The Zapatistas, the EZLN, was first organized by a Cuban-inspired party movement, which had its root in the late 60s and was based on the Foucault theory of Che Guevara, which is different from traditionally what we envisage as participatory democracy. And this focus on participatory democracy is seen in a lot of writings, also by other solidarity activists, Saramago, Klein, Montalban. But it is also important to notice that while the link between participatory democracy and being indigenous is made quite explicit often in the global solidarity movement, being indigenous was not something that was mentioned in the first declaration in 1994. That came later. That came after the contact with the global solidarity movement, which is a process that can also be observed many other places, for instance in Nicaragua. Sometimes you need to be seen from the outside to see that there's links between being Tzotzil, Tzeltal, Tokulubal with Aymara and Miskito. I tried to say a few things about that too, but that is the weakest part of the article, so I'll skip it. But going back to 1996, I argue that the meaning of autonomy from an indigenous perspective is different from the meaning of autonomy which most of the members of the global solidarity movement had. The meaning of autonomy made it possible, or demanding autonomy made it possible to connect to the international law as expressed in the conventions ILO 169, which is ILO is United Nations body, and there's an expert committee following up the countries signing the convention. And the argument behind that is only understandable if you accept that some cultural rights can only be exercised in a meaningful manner if it is exercised by a community. And that distinguishes this understanding of collective rights from other rights, which often has the intention of making themselves redundant against discrimination. These collective rights are seen as permanent. I also tried to see how this can be connected to social ecology and deep ecology, trying to link the Zapatista cause to the deep ecology tradition. And as a matter of fact, it was in resistance to being expelled from natural reserves in the Lacandon that many joined the Zapatista army in the first place. And my time. time is out, so let's conclude. I had three conclusions. Obviously, being here, I find that anarchist literature can shed light on the Zapatista case, of course. I also say that understanding these key issues, especially deep ecology and social ecology and autonomy, will help understand why the global movement sort of not disappeared, but became gradually weaker. And this is not a critique of the Zapatistas. In my view, they could not have done anything differently. And it also should lead us to carefully reconsider the inflated importance in some of the theories I showed in the beginning.
Fantastic. Great.
Okay, so next we have Daniel Murray from Stanford.
I don't like this. Oh, April's gone. We can see you.
So first I'd like to just quickly thank the conference organizers, which I'm getting to understand. It sounds like it's pretty much a one-man show with Alex here.
And the IT people.
And the IT people played a critical role here. And also to the attendees, thanks for a lot of great papers, and we've already had some excellent presentations. Coming from Stanford, there's few opportunities to discuss some of these ideas, so I'm excited for the opportunity here. It's quite a long trip across the pond, but I didn't want to let it pass through my fingers like an American gull on an English keeper. but I have to admit, in all seriousness, this is my first conference, so I'm quite excited. First and foremost, to learn, and I'm excited and welcome suggestions, comments, critiques, questions. Without further ado, so my paper is called Democratic Insurrection, or What Does the Ultra-Globalization Movement Have in Common? It kind of looks at similar themes that I think are in April's and Roy's papers, and some of the things that have been discussed already today as well. So the Ultra-Globalization Movement is a project for democracy, but a kind of radical democracy that's quite alien to those living in what are commonly called democratic states. For the movement, the perversion of democracy has emptied it of meaning and replaced it with a palatable imperialism, an accepted aristocracy, and a passive dependence. It seeks to overcome this perversion through a project of constructive resistance. So examining the ultra-globalization movement, I focus on three motivating questions. First and foremost, what forms of resistance are possible that both value the irreducibility of difference and allow for the possibility of large-scale collective action? Second, are these forms necessarily egalitarian and liberatory? And third, which I won't really be able to discuss here due to time constraints, do these forms hold outside of the world of social movement activity in the more mundane issues of politics like resource management? Radical democratic theory has sought to conceptualize a politics that values diversity and collectivity, but has done so in a limited sense. Building on Michael Hart and Antonio Negri's concept of the common, I'll attempt to show that the ultra-globalization movement exhibits new forms of collective action that enable both the ceaseless becoming of open and flexible relationships and global collective action. So I'll first provide a bit of theoretical background, drawing out some of the limits of radical democratic theory and some critiques issued by anarchist and post-structuralist theory, then turn to the ultra-globalization movement to examine what I call the forum affinity network structure, its possible limitations, and finally, I'll conclude with some brief words on how I hope to and have begun to expand on this research. While the growing literature on radical democracy exhibits a diverse range of perspectives, we'll focus on three salient features that have emerged among the many interpretations. First, many concepts of radical democracy are based in attempts to reform liberal democratic institutions. As one of the major proponents, Chantal Mouffe, has written, quote, "The aim is not to create a completely different kind of society, but to use the symbolic resources of the liberal democratic tradition to struggle against relations of subordination." And second, the critical site of radical democratic practice is typically not found in political institutions themselves, but in civil society. Some, such as Ernesto Laclau, posit a hegemonic collective subject such as the people, linking race, class, and gender-based struggles, ostensibly outside of the state. And third, some such as Jacques Rancière have focused on the importance of demands by the excluded for inclusion in the political. For Rancière, each contestation of the political produces a more inclusive, more democratic political space. Anarchists and post-structuralist critiques challenge these three features of radical democracy for their dependence on the state and hegemonic identities. In Gramsci is Dead, Richard Day, who's come up a number of times already today, takes aim at both. He argues that radical democracy relies on, quote, a logic of representation of interests within a state-regulated system of hegemonic struggles, end quote, which requires the flattening of difference, the limitation of autonomy, and concentration of power. Mouffe insists on the importance of liberal democratic institutions to regulate struggles and rejects any sort of truly radical social political transformation. Laclau's hegemonic the people depends on essentializing nodes of identification such as race and class, and Rancière's emphasis on a more inclusive space is theorized in terms of a demand to those in power, ultimately legitimizing the ruling state or corporate power. For many in the ultra-globalization movement, these attempts are inadequate. Instead, they proclaim another world is possible. So instead of the hegemonic identities of Laclau and Mouffe, I look to post-structural concepts of becoming minor and singularity, which conceptualize an ontology of difference that ceaselessly resists grounding in any particular identity or form of representation. However, taken to their limit, becoming minor and singularity can lead to a totalization of the particular, which would preclude any possibility of political action. Each individual would be isolated in their particularity, their individuality, their total autonomy. But for many social movements, as we saw with the Zapatistas, autonomy is a collective project. To address this problem of collectivity and autonomy, Hart and Negri have sought to redefine the concept of the common, which among other things refers to shared languages, values, and knowledges, a shared medium of communication that both allows for and is produced by communication and social practice. The common varies between relations, and this variation has a direct impact on the possibility of radical democracy. The more robust the common, the greater the possibility of such a practice. And what's key for my analysis is that I argue that the practice of democracy need not occur in one moment or even a smooth succession of moments, but that the ultra-globalization movement demonstrates that the moments of democratic practice can be fragmented across time and space. Within the ultra-globalization movement, three distinct moments of radical democracy can be found: deliberation, decision, and action. Deliberation may occur in Brazil, decision in London, and action globally, all as part of an expanded practice of radical democracy. This fragmentation of democratic practice allows for a range of organizational forms, demonstrating the possibilities for fluid and flexible collectivities that do not rely on hegemony but are still capable of large-scale action. So now we'll turn to the alter-globalization movement itself. The movement exhibits three organizational forms, each of which clearly exhibits a particular democratic moment. The inclusive open spaces of movement-wide social forums function most effectively as spaces of deliberation, small friend-like affinity groups for decision, and the networks that produce large-scale protest events and global days of action for action. So we'll look at each of these in turn. Ideally, deliberation is a process of debate and discussion based on reasons, but governed by norms of openness and respect. In the deliberative process, through exposure to a diversity of reasons, values, and subjectivities are transformed, the common is produced. Within the alter-globalization movement, deliberation in its purest form is found in the social forum. The World Social Forum Charter of Principles states, quote, "The forum is an open meeting place for reflective thinking, democratic debate of ideas, formulation of proposals, free exchange of experiences, and interlinking of effective action." This deliberative process is open in the sense that it's not exclusive, but it's also open in the sense that it is not conclusive. The deliberation that is at the core of the forum does not necessarily lead to a decision, as a final single decision on behalf of the forum would require the silencing of some voices and limit diversity. Given the scale of up to 100,000 participants, decision that truly respects difference is impossible. Of course, there are important limitations to the forum's ability to achieve its stated goals. Some activists have complained that discussions are controlled by a small elite of longtime activists or celebrity intellectuals, and participation in the forum at the most basic level of attendance is also limited. Local groups and activists are always disproportionately represented, and there's a distinct north-south divide in participation. But deliberation more generally faces its own limits, as it depends upon the quality of the discourse. The unevenness of discursive skills can work to limit equal access to deliberation or equal power in the deliberative process. Given these important limitations, truly radical democracy cannot be practiced on the scale of the forum as a whole, but the forum does provide a space to construct the common that can serve as the basis for radically democratic relations. The forum may play a critical role in facilitating the rhizomatic network structure necessary for radical democracy on a global scale. So, to the affinity group. Decision at the most is the most demanding moment in the practice of radical democracy. It requires the strongest form of the common, and it follows that the group the scale of the group must be the most limited. Decision in radical democracy is also the most difficult to separate from other moments in radical democratic process, particularly deliberation. Deliberation, as we saw, can exist without decision, but on the other hand, decision, on the other hand, within radical democracy cannot be reached without deliberation. A truly collective decision must value the preferences of all members equally and be a decision to which all members can agree. Decision in radical democratic practice can be reached through an arduous process of deliberation aimed at consensus. Within the ultra-globalization movement, collective decisions are most democratically reached most democratically within small affinity groups. These groups, generally composed of 5 to 20 individuals, are founded on friend-like relationships and for a particular task. The affinity group serves as the ideal type for the consensus-based decision-making necessary for radical democracy. The common exists here in its most robust form, most robust and permanent form, through shared values, goals, histories, vocabularies, processes, and importantly, obligations. However, the claim to idealism is only relative. Affinity groups and the process of consensus decision-making are by no means entirely free of domination and hierarchy. Power may function unconsciously through, for instance, a lack of gender parity in the decision-making process, or the relegation of certain individuals to certain tasks. These imbalances can function according to categories of race, gender, or class, but also can be based on other inequalities, such as experience or close friendships within the group. While the consensus process is an attempt to channel conflict into cooperation, affinity groups can also limit difference, and even be experienced as exclusion areas of those outside the group. Despite these limitations, consensus-based decision-making within the affinity group most closely fulfills the rigorous demands of radical democracy, requiring and producing the common in its strongest form, but on a small scale. So action within the ultra-globalization movement happens at numerous levels. Affinity groups don't merely make decisions and call it a day, they act on these decisions. However, action in common does not require deliberation or collective decision-making among the entire community. This sort of action is similar to swarm intelligence, as Roy alluded to, or complex systems by which groups of insects can act without a central authority. The ultra-globalization movement, particularly the direct action wing of the movement, largely expresses itself through a kind of insurrection, large-scale acts of resistance such as summit crashing and global days of action. With these actions, activists and organizations from around the world converge in a single point or act simultaneously in multiple locations. The nature of the common at such actions is necessarily weak, though there is typically some coordination through spokes councils and other forms. Though there is no central authority in these actions, this does not necessarily guarantee that they're egalitarian either. As in the case of the forum, some groups and individuals are more able to participate. Further, the actions themselves are limited. The central goal for many of these large-scale actions, beginning with Seattle, and actually before that, has been shut them down. But this has only occurred on a few occasions, and even when this goal has been achieved, the tangible effects amount to little more than a more secluded and secure summit the next time around. Still, action on the scale and the coordination of affinity groups is an important moment in the radical democratic process, especially given the nature of the enemy. This action may not stem directly from a collective decision, but does rest on the development of the common at other moments in the process. Deliberation at the forum and decision in the affinity group produce the common necessary for action in the network. Each of these three movements of the radical democracy, deliberation, decision, and action, is best suited to a particular scale and organizational form. Social forum, affinity group, and network, respectively. Each forum fills a particular role in the ultra-globalization movement and the production of the common, but none is entirely isolated from the others. As such, we must consider these elements as a system, forum, affinity, network. Such a system avoids the hegemonic tendencies of Laclau's notion of the people, as well as the reformist forms of radical democracy that limit difference and autonomy of various individuals, communities, and struggles. Within this system, radically democratic practice is produced through a range of scales, complexities, and intensities. Further, some tasks are better accomplished through global action, some through local. The form affinity network system allows for this possibility. Needless to say, the model has limitations at which we've only thus hinted. First and foremost, while this model illustrates the possibility for radically democratic organization within the ultra-globalization movement, it doesn't provide a means for movement building or organization beyond the movement itself. In the ultra-globalization movement, movement building must play a central role. The form affinity network structure and the typical insurrectionary acts of the movement are limited in their capacity to accomplish this. Further, as we saw in both the forum and the affinity group, systemic inequality leads to multiple obstacles for radical democracy. We've already mentioned a number of these issues. A formal consensus process can serve to mitigate some level of inequality within the group, but again, this process does not bring people to the table. In my current research with climate justice groups, I've seen how such processes can serve to alienate newcomers and produce exclusionary groups of relatively homogenous activists. Similarly, a lack of equitable participation has plagued both the social fora and networked direct actions. Though through the concept of the common, we're able to focus on what is necessary to produce the conditions for radically democratic social relations, but movement building is necessary to expand the reach of the common, rather than waiting for excluded populations to demand inclusion. Finally, in the paper, I argue for the importance of material resource management as a necessary task for the ultra-globalization movement, but I don't have time to discuss it here. So this paper, though based partly on ethnographies and other qualitative empirical research of the movement, has been largely theoretical. More research must be focused on the limitations of these democratic moments. The common as an abstract theoretical concept has been kept necessarily opaque, and we've only been able to reveal the major contours of its unevenness. Extended ethnographic research can reveal the continued transformation of these practices. To what extent are affinity groups actually free of domination? What prevents its eradication? How do power relations function positively, productively, and equitably within these arrangements? I've recently begun to research these questions with a network of climate justice groups in the San Francisco Bay Area, and in fact, we headed from the conference to Detroit for the U.S. Social Forum. In conclusion, while the ultra-globalization movement and the forum affinity network structure open new possibilities for radical democracy, a new concept of insurrection is necessary to overcome its limitations. Individuals and groups participating in a multiplicity of radically democratic relations can work to extend the network, to extend the forum rhizomatically, establishing a dense network. Indeed, if radical democracy is at all possible on the global scale, it's through this network forum, but requires the social forum and the affinity group as well. The codification of these points of resistance through the common is an important first step in this project of democratic insurrection.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Okay, are you going to put a share screen there?
April, are you going to do the share screen thing?
Yes, I'm going to bring it up right now. Let me know when you can see it.
How we want to work out time.
Okay, we can see it. Alrighty.
Okay.
Go ahead, April.
Okay, fantastic.
Alright, I'd like to start with a bit of contextualization. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Bolivia. So Bolivia is roughly the size of the UK and France combined, and maybe just a little bit bigger, and it has a population of about 11 million people. Despite being extremely rich in natural resources, in terms of per capita income, it's one of the poorest countries in Latin America. And people squabble over the numbers, but it's generally acknowledged that Bolivia is the most indigenous population in Latin America. Can you hear me?
Yeah, okay.
So the numbers range between 55 and 70% of the population. There's over 36 different indigenous languages spoken throughout the country, reflecting the many indigenous cultures. The Aymara and Quechua, on which I focus alone, account for 55% of the population. Since the time of colonization, the indigenous population have been denied equal citizenship and have been excluded from positions of state and capitalist power. And because of this long-standing exclusion, they have long been construed as passive and marginal actors. But what I'd like to argue here is that they only seem passive, marginal, and disorganized from the modernist and Eurocentric perspective of the state and colonial elite. There's growing evidence and support for the argument that many of Bolivia's indigenous peoples have successfully resisted colonization by maintaining, reproducing, and adapting their own forms of organization, cooperation, and leadership. The extent of their skill and organization only becomes visible at least to outsiders, during moments of crisis, and those unfamiliar with indigenous practices, for those who are unfamiliar with indigenous practices, the success of Bolivian mobilizations can seem quite baffling. I'll take a minute here to illustrate what I mean. Between 2000 and 2005, Bolivia was rocked by almost continuous protests. Between January and April 2000, rural farmers, factory workers, students, and neighborhood groups mobilized in a prolonged series of protests known as the Cochabamba Water War to put an end to a water privatization scheme. They managed to force the cancellation of a multinational corporation's contract and the return of water management to public hands, So that was quite a significant victory for them. And then between October 2003 and June 2005, massive protests erupted in El Alto and La Paz. La Paz is the capital, and El Alto is sometimes considered a suburb of La Paz, and others considered it a separate city. So I'll get into that later. But protests erupted again between 2003 and 2005 over a proposed gas pipeline plan, which would have brought natural gas from the eastern lowlands to Chile, where it would have been liquefied for export to the U.S. and to Mexico. So using, again, tactics such as highway blockades, mass mobilizations, and street fights with the military, sometimes sustained for periods of months at a time, the protests forced the resignation of two presidents and successfully put a stop to the plans. So I'd like to take a minute here to explain just how massive and incredible these movements were. Here, you should be seeing now a picture of people walking in from the countryside. So that's the first thing that's impressive. They managed sometimes to walk for days, sometimes up to more than a week, in order to get to these protest events. So that in and of itself requires a lot of cooperation and organization. Once they actually got to the city where the protests were being held, they often stayed with either with friends of the family or with family members in preparation or during the extended protest that would last weeks or up to months. And then they would gather into squares. This here is a picture of people gathering up in a square in El Alto before walking down to La Paz. And you should be seeing any moment now people walking down from El Alto to La Paz, which is, La Paz is kind of in a valley bowl below El Alto. And this is at about, that's a very high altitude. So I'm showing the pictures of them coming down just so you can have an idea of how massive these protests really were. The next one here is them congregating and massing in the squares of La Paz. And you can see in these pictures that they're there by the hundreds of thousands, which is impressive enough if they're managing this over a day. But given that they were managing this for days, weeks, sometimes months, it really illustrates the kind of organization and cooperation needed to sustain this over such a long period of time and in such large numbers. So in fact, as early as 2001, Alvaro Garcia Linera, which is the current vice president of the country, said that the movements represent, and I quote here, an organizing force capable of challenging the relevance of prevailing systems of government and capable of erecting alternative systems for the exercise of political power and the conduct of legitimately democratic life. So it's really impressive, and by the way, this is the Wipala, which is the traditional flag of the Quechua and Aymara, the Kulasuyu, which is a part of the ancient Inca Empire. So what I'm looking at here, what I'm wondering is how it is that one of the poorest populations in Latin America is managing to engage in such prolonged and effective mobilizations, and how it is that they can force their governments to renege on international commitments to the World Bank and to break contracts with transnational corporations. These sustained and effective mobilizations are baffling from the perspective of prevailing social movement theories. I can explain why if you want during the question period, but for now I'd like to focus on emerging explanations. Students of Bolivia are beginning to argue that in order to understand the power and effectiveness of Bolivian mobilization and resistance, we need to look beyond the elite actors and even beyond the major mediatized events, such as the gas and water wars that I just mentioned, to the everyday practices of most Bolivians. One of the foremost scholars arguing this is Silvia Rivera Cusicanqui. She's an Aymara sociologist in La Paz. She focuses much of her attention on the centuries-old practices enacted within the Aymara and Quechua Ailus, or communities. So Ailus were the basic political, social, and economic units in the Andes before colonization. And many have survived to this day. They're basically organized to be self-sustaining units to meet the needs of Ailu members in terms of food, shelter, clothing, and education. So ideally, each Ailu owns a parcel of land which extends over several ecosystems in different altitudes, and the members have reciprocal obligations to each other. So families master different ecosystems and trade with each other in the Ailu in order to access the goods of all the ecosystems. And Kwasi Kyamki emphasizes that one of the main values of the ILO system is the notion of reciprocity, which is formalized in specific Aymara and Quechua practices. The Aymara practice the Añi, and the Quechua practice the Mita, which are services rendered with the obligatory repayment of equal kind and terms of labor. And these amount to formal processes of mutual aid and are at the heart of communal practice in the Andes. Now, despite these communal practices, concentrations of power and wealth measured in land and kin, for example, does occur, which leads to power imbalances. But the Ailu have included mechanisms to counteract the concentration of wealth and power in their modes of leadership. The offices of both civil and religious leaders are rotational, and ideally during the life of an individual, he or she takes a turn at being leader. And the crucial point here is that these offices are not revenue-generating, but post of public service. So being a leader entails a significant contribution of one's time and resources, such as food, drink, and so on. So it's generally those with the most resources that are chosen to be leaders. And as prosperous men and women move through the positions of leadership, their expenditures serve to redistribute wealth and resources throughout the families of the Ailu. Now you should be seeing a picture of El Alto. The first one on the left is the picture of the oldest settlements in El Alto. And the one to the right is the newer neighborhoods that have been built more recently. So these characteristics that I've just described in the Ailus might have been expected to decline with increasing urbanization, but they're being recreated in cities throughout Bolivia. And El Alto may well represent the most striking contemporary expression of anarchist practices in the country. The city is a rapidly expanding, mostly indigenous Aymara and Quechua population, and has a long history of struggle due in part to its strategic location above La Paz. It wasn't until neoliberal reforms led to massive displacement of indigenous people from their rural communities in Ailus to El Alto, though, that it gained the unique form, urban form that it has today. For example, in 1976, the city only had a population of about 95,000 people, and today the population has jumped to more than a million. So if you look at the new neighborhoods, these have been built since 1976 in a time where there was a massive increase in population. So it's pretty impressive to see just how organized and orderly everything is, given that these people are extremely poor and have very limited resources. So the most arresting characteristic of the city is that it was built by and for the residents and that it's largely self-managed. More than 1,000 neighborhood councils combined to make the Federation of Neighborhood Councils of El Alto, and most residents of the city are part of a council where they engage in works of collective solidarity and mutual aid to build and improve their city. And reflecting the rich heritage and tradition of organization, the Aymara and Quechua Ailus, the councils are organized horizontally in such a way that encourages radical participatory democracy while inhibiting the concentration of power. The city also reflects the Ailu's economic practices, and that residents of El Alto often maintain dual residence in the city and in the countryside. So parts of the extended family work and travel throughout the countryside in order to obtain the raw materials, food, goods, which can then be traded or sold as finished products at the massive markets in El Alto and La Paz and other cities. And these markets then serve as hubs to redistribute things throughout the countryside, again, throughout the family systems. So once we recognize these practices for what they are, the mobilization seems less baffling. These Ailu characteristics, the communal spirit, the self-organized quality, and the different conception of leadership, which have been reproduced in cities such as El Alto, constitute a strong organizational advantage in times of crisis because it allows protests to take off and to be maintained without the need for huge mobilization of monetary resources or centralized planning and leadership. It's precisely because protest actions and mobilizations rely on intensified versions of skills that people already practice in their everyday life that Bolivian indigenous peoples can carry them out so effectively and skillfully. Okay, so that concludes my presentation. Have you been able to hear everything? Because I couldn't see any of you during.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.